Hello and welcome to Spring. And Spring brings another episode of your favorite D&D show, Mastering Dungeons. I'm Sean Merwin here with Duke basketball fan. So far, so oh, he's putting on the horns. He's putting on those. Oh, he's got the Duke banner. You can tell it's NCAA basketball March Madness time. Because despite getting bounced early in the ACC tournament, Teos and his Blue Devils are still alive in
Yeah,
the big
we
dance.
somehow I've just knocked my mic like nine times, but it was gorgeous, a gorgeous, gorgeous weekend. Yesterday was fantastic with an incredible game. Jared McCain, all-time Duke leader now for three pointers in a game with eight. He had six. He had 22 points in the first half, 30 for the game. And I know this is the coverage that everybody wants. It's the Mike Shea Sports Hour, but Duke women. We're down 16 in the second quarter against Ohio State, playing at Ohio State, because that's how women's basketball is sometimes. NCAA tourney at your home court when you're the number two seed. Well, Duke, despite being the lower seed, came back from behind, ended up winning by 12. Shout out to the Lady Blue Devils. That was rocking. It was a delicious game to watch. Just a joyous weekend of basketball, the way that it should be every weekend.
Yeah, I generally watch the first few games of the tournament,
But you were
but
somewhere.
I was at Gary Con, yes. So I did not get the chance to see any of the games, but I did get a chance to play some games, and I did get a chance to run some games, where the lower seed generally won.
I
No,
see
it
what you
was
did
a
there.
very nice show. It was my first time there. Very nice. Lots of people, lots of games, lots of friendly faces, lots of new faces. Got to rub elbows with some people I hadn't met before, get to reacquaint myself with some I had. So very nice. Interesting town, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. Neat tourist town, lots of restaurants, lots of bars. The facility was this huge, sprawling resort. So that was cool to see. I don't know is that I would go back unless I was working, but that's how I attend a lot of shows, so I can't say it won't happen. But definitely a nice show. The one thing about it was loud, because while the resort is sprawling, there are only so many areas in which people congregate, and every single one of those areas was packed, and every single one of those areas was loud. I bought, based on something that Thomas Valley, who ran the Adventurers League content there, said, I bought a portable amp, basically, where you put a headset on and it shoots your voice out. And it saved me, Teos. It saved my life.
Because the rooms were that loud that you as
The rooms
DM.
were the AL room was so loud that if I had had to yell over, my voice would have been shot the first day. I'm talking normally here on a Monday after a con where I ran four games and played some games and had a lot of meetings to talk. It was the best. And I apologize to Ginny Loveday and any other DM where if I was pointing in your direction and it was too loud, Ginny was not afraid to tell me to turn the bl blanking thing down. So that's great. But if it was too loud at anybody else, overcoming anyone else's voice, I apologize. Next time, throw things at me.
That's the future is where you'll have a wireless mesh network just for your table where everybody can hear. You know, you'll do voice chat, but at the table.
And I could, people could hear me. I could only hear about two in every six of my players. So I did a lot of leaning over and
Oh yeah, rooms
holding
like
ear
that are
up.
rough. That
Yeah.
is tough. I
But
really
it was the
love
whole,
quiet rooms.
it was the whole convention, because when I was in the hotel or when I was in the restaurant, it was noisy. When I was at the bar, obviously, it's always noisy, but it was even more so. So it was rough in that sense, but again, I'm an old man now, so kids these days with their loudness.
In my
But
day,
what
we
was
could
an
hear each other talk at the
exactly?
table.
And another thing that was interesting was I ran AL again. I haven't sat down and like run AL for four slots. It's been years. It's been literal years. And I was worried. I was worried that I had lost the step. I was worried I wouldn't. It was great. It was so much fun. The three tables where I ran a normal Dream of the Red Wizards adventure, so much fun. The adventure I ran was a really interesting premise with a lot of cool things, but it was fundamentally flawed to the point where I had to like cut full encounters out and move things around and do things differently. And I did so on the fly, and it was great. It was fun
Wow.
to be able to in real time say,
Yeah.
wait, okay, no, I need to move this here, move this there. It was so much fun.
That's great.
And of course, we had a lot of news drop there,
Yep.
and we will be covering that news shortly. But I wanted to get to just to one thing in the listener corner. Various people have, via YouTube or via whatever means, said similar things, such as what boils down to is, how dare you criticize Shadow Dark? And I want to, I mean, some people were just like, obviously they don't listen to the show and they heard that we were talking about it, so they came and were upset that
Yeah.
we weren't as complimentary to Shadow Dark as they would have been. And so, how dare we criticize Shadow Dark? We dare because we're not criticizing it. We're not criticizing the game. We're not criticizing its creators. What we did was discuss the words on the page and looked at how those words came together to express ideas and to make rules to play a game. I don't think we were overly critical. If you want to hear a critical review of something, go look at our reviews of the Wizards products that have come out recently. That is right. Some people will say, why are you punching down? Why aren't you punching up? We're not punching down. Like, Shadow Dark is way up here. Shadow Dark is above Teos and me. Shadow Dark is good, and it's popular, and it's fun, and we are not punching down at it. And when we punch up, we are punching up at Wizards of the Coast products, the same way we look at Shadow Dark, right? We're holding those two things in equal esteem by just looking at the words, not who
Yeah.
made them, not anything else, but just that.
And the punching is a critique that comes from a critique rather than a criticism, an analysis, right? That comes from our respect for what comes into making products like this, right?
Sure.
Whether it's an adventure that Wizards of the Coast wrote, that we find parts of it to be problematic, right? We always come in rooting, right? We always come in excited, hoping that it'll be the coolest thing we've ever seen, and that we will learn from it, right? And we truly always learn from it. So that part's always great. And sometimes it's not the best thing we've ever seen, and sometimes it's far from it, or it's close to it. It really varies. But a lot of times, even like if you look at our reviews of old classic adventures, right? We reviewed the first Dragonlance adventure. Absolutely, I wanted to open it up and find that, wow, this was a hidden gem that was perfect in every way. It isn't, And so what we're doing in our analysis is trying to provide a framework and an understanding that others can use to analyze their works and to build their own works. Whether you're homebrewing or you are working for somebody as a freelancer, or you are using some product and you want to know and think about how to use it, then the hope is that that's helpful, right? With Shadow Dark, somebody out there is going to make the next Shadow Dark, we hope. And so it's good to learn from it, right? What is absolutely amazing about it? What could use a few tweaks? What kind of falls a little flat? And of course, that's for us. It's always different at everybody's table. And there's a real big difference between the type of analysis we're doing, which is kind of a clinical, designer kind of view, and the is this game amazing to play? I mean, AD&D was amazing to play for me for years. If I were to analyze it, and I have, it has some issues. So the two things are not incompatible. You can have an incredible, incredible experience with products that have many flaws and are still great products.
And I played Shadow Dark at GaryCon. I thought it was a 4-hour event, and I got there, and it turned out it was only a 2-hour event. And it was run by someone who I played D&D with, have seen run D&D, an amazing game master. Weird Dave Coulson. Anybody who's been in AL for a while might, or if you've been to conventions, you know Weird Dave. He calls himself Weird Dave, so I'm not like disparaging him. And he had this terrain set up with this castle, and it was really like super nicely done. And he runs an incredible game, no matter what game he runs. Great role player, knows the rules. So I sat down ready for this Shadow Dark experience, and it was 2 hours of D&D Light. We really didn't get into the rules that make Shadow Dark different from a D&D variant. It wasn't
Interesting.
like we got hit and we dropped the torch. It was changed so that, right, you could use the luck tokens for different things. And Dave basically said, I'm not running Shadow Dark by the rules. I'm running a convention experience using Shadow Dark as the base. So I got to play in a really fun game with fun players, a great DM, a GM in this case, and it wasn't Shadow Dark. Right? There
Well,
wasn't the
and
Shadow Dark
maybe
we read.
I think one of the reasons people, you know, it's funny, we've reviewed a number of different games, and Shadow Dark probably got the most feedback, let's say, of people saying to us, why did you not like this game when we do like the game? And I think it's because I think the number of people is because, of course, it's popular and it means something to them, but also because Shadow Dark is open enough that so many DMs can make it what they want it to be. As happened at your table, right? And that means that the game is exactly what you want it to be because you are doing things to it beyond what's in the written page, right? And our analysis goes back to the written page. Sure, brings in some of our play experiences for feedback, but it's really based on that. And but that's really interesting to hear that this you came ready for a full Shadow Dark experience and
And I talked to other folks who played not just in that game, but in different games. And I said, "How was your experience?" And they said the exact same thing I did. They said, "I was expecting, the torches to be this important and these random elements and this and that and the other thing." And it just turned into a D&D light. And so I can see why this game is so popular if, as you say, it's a light version of D&D that people can put their experiences over and tweak to make it, especially with the OSR crowd that Gary Kahn draws. There were probably more sessions of Shadow Dark offered there than any other game other than variants of D&D. So that shows you how well this game has captured the imagination of that audience, which is what we've been saying, right, as we review it. And that's one of the brilliant things about it. So I just wanted to, and I also want to add that I had several people come up to me and said, we listened or I listened to your review of Shadow Dark and I bought it based on your recommendation. So that made me feel better. Because I'm always going to feel guilty that, oh, were we too harsh, right? That sort of thing. And hearing that people said that I didn't know about it, I wasn't interested in it. But then when you talked about it, it made me want to go out and buy it. So that sort of assuaged my fear that we were in fact unfair or too harsh.
I've heard folks say that too, and that's always our goal too, is knowing no matter how great a game is, it's not for everybody, right? No matter how good an adventure I write, some people will go that it was not the experience I wanted. That's the way it goes, right? And so by talking about it, hopefully those folks who are interested in that kind of experience will check it out. And we'll do so, with some good knowledge that they can take into the experience. And those who really know that this is not what they want will go, okay, yeah, that certainly sounds like what I don't want. Like I was listening, reading someone's write-up of how they played Eclipse Phase, which is a very meaty game, and how much they absolutely love that. And I thought to myself, well, that's probably a person that, may not want to try a game like Shadow Dark. I mean, maybe they would, but they're enjoying the incredibly long skill list and all of that. These are all features that are pleasing to them, right? And so it's just different games for different folks, right?
So with that, let's jump quickly into our news and commentary section, starting with a bit of sad news that happened just before Gary Kahn. Jim Ward, has passed away. Jim is a legendary game designer. He was at 72 this last week. He was one of the first players at Gary Gygax's game. He played the wizard Dromage, which is Jim Ward backwards. There's a great story where he ran into Gary Gygax at a bookstore, and they liked the same book, and we're looking at the same books, and they started talking about games, and he ended up being invited to Gary's Castle Greyhawk game. Jim worked at TSR, worked on many fine books there, and the first sci-fi RPG, Metamorphosis Alpha, and later he worked on the first post-apocalyptic game, Gamma World. He co-wrote Supplement 4 for OD&D. He worked on AD&D's Deities and Demigods, the hardback book Greyhawk Adventures, and so much more. Deities and Demigods was like the book that I used most. It just drew me in with all of that. And so, 10% of my love of D&D started with that book.
We could do a show just on that, right? How that has changed. But
Yeah.
I absolutely loved that book when I was young. I think everything that I loved about mythology came alive through that book. It exposed me to new mythologies that I hadn't worked with, and it just made you want to create different types of characters, and it was a fantastic book.
I basically passed a Greek and Roman mythology class that I had to take my freshman year because I probably could have taken the final exam and passed just based on what was in the Deities and Demigods book. In the 80s, Jim and Rose Estes started an education department at TSR, planning to market classroom modules to teachers because Jim had been a teacher before going to TSR. He worked for 4 years at TSR, got laid off and freelanced, got rehired, went through that whole cycle. Everything old is new again, Teos, right? People getting laid off and
Sure is.
freelance and coming back. He became the director of design and development and then the vice president of design. What else do you know or remember
Yeah, I
about
mean, I
Jim?
read a great write-up by Shannon Appelkline, who's just, I mean, the obituary master. I mean, he has such an understanding of everything that people have done and can draw from so many sources. He wrote that when he looks at Jim Ward was making, he says, many of the most crucial decisions for the advancement of D&D during that second edition era. And he says, quote, "If Gary Gygax was the architect for D&D during its earliest days at TSR, Jim Ward was that architect for the end of the TSR era. By then, he was also one of the people with the most extensive histories at the company and thus the most institutional knowledge. It was here that he had perhaps his greatest impact on Dungeons and Dragons and on the role-playing field as a whole." And his character is revealed when in 1996 TSR tells him, "Hey, this is all going downhill. You've got to lay off most of your staff." And he says, "Nope, I'm not doing that. I quit." Rather than lay off his staff, he just says, "I'm not refusing those great people. I'm out of here." Right. And he worked with a bunch of other companies after that, Trollord Games, recently with Goodman Games, the Metamorphosis Alpha remake just came out not too long ago, so he really worked right up to the end. And we've linked to that Shannon Appelkline article in our show notes at designers-and-dragons.com. Really nice write-up. Thanks, Jim, for all that you did.
Thank you so much. D&D has announced that they are going to reinstate early access for local game stores. So these local game stores in the US and Canada will be able to release original and alt cover versions of major D&D releases up to 2 weeks prior to the global release date. This program is similar to the one that they had earlier in the fifth edition era, but it's no longer dependent on the overall Wizards Play Network status of those stores. So for Vecna Eve of Ruin, stores will be able to sell it on May 7th ahead of the May 21 general release. This is for in-store sales only, not online or shipped orders. So we've got Vecna Eve of Ruin, Quests from the Infinite Staircase, the Player's Handbook for 2024, the DMG for 2024, and the Monster Manual of 2025, all being released early if you purchase it in store at your friendly local game store.
It's really great to see that. I was surprised by it because before they'd said, you know, oh, this was hard to maintain. We're canceling this when they kind of stopped this program. And it was also, I think, a little contentious in that you had to be a certain type of store with, through your WPN status to qualify for it. So I really like seeing this back. I think stores need that help, especially because Wizards is now offering freebies when you pre-order on their sites, right? So
Right.
it's interesting. I wonder if Wizards is somewhat trying to say, look, wouldn't it be great if we could get more sales from direct sales, of course, but then have the other sales not be Amazon sales, but be or online, you know, large discounters, and instead be gaming stores for the rest of it, which would be a better split than Amazon. But it's always complicated, but either way, this is something that I think is a breath of fresh air for the gaming stores out there.
Yeah. In further support of gaming stores, Wizards announced earlier that Descent into the Lost Caverns of Socanth will be launching March 29th and runnable through April 29th, where stores can play this event in a tournament mode by tracking the time and the scoring, or just play it as standard play. And stores can res will receive this adventure on March 26th, so tomorrow. And then distribute it to their DMs. And then finally, on March,
Before you get into that, I
May.
just want to
Oh,
ask,
go
Sean,
ahead.
did you get to play or hear about Descent into Lost Caverns? Because that
I
was
did
running there,
not
right?
get a chance to play it, but it ran during GaryCon. So I didn't really hear much of, I only heard like gossipy things, not about the event itself, but oh, I had this player or I had that player. Oh, did you see this? I didn't hear anything specifically about the adventure, except someone who I trust very much to judge these things, who was a DM for it, said it was the perfect epic event, the way
Cool.
it was written.
That's great. Yeah.
So,
And I don't know if it's the same person or not, but Dave Rosser had a kind of positive thing on Twitter, which I appreciated hearing. So yeah, cool. I look forward
It
to
was not Dave,
seeing
although I saw Dave while I was there.
it. Cool.
So yeah,
Yeah.
that's good. And then on May 17th to 19th, there's a crossover Magic the Gathering event that will be celebrating the 50 years of D&D, Baldur's Gate 3, and Magic. There will be a draft event for Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate. This event will support four special dungeon cards for the event, which can be downloaded from the link in our show notes.
That
So,
surprised me a bit, but it's cool and it makes sense. You know, hey, remember there are these cards that So let's have a special Commander Legends Battle for Baldur's Gate event May 17th. That's great.
And we've seen this relationship between Wizards and game stores, right? During D&D encounters, there it was super well supported, and the game stores felt close to Wizards, and taking, or at least most, the ones that I dealt with, and there were many, all loved it and wanted more, and were willing to like report back results. And then, then they go away, and you can almost see it. It's like everything else with companies and with Wizards in this case, where it's like game stores are super important. We need to support them as well, best we can. Game stores are not important at all, and we need to focus on these other things. And then it swings the pendulum, swings back to game stores are very important, and we need to support them and help them. And since it's not necessarily a measurable thing,
Right.
it's easy for the higher ups who s rely on analytics to say, are game stores really that important? And then you get different answers depending on who is in certain positions at different times.
I love studying the sort of varying level of support between home play, which is almost never a big push, convention play, and store play. And it's just wild. You can just graph those three things over the years, and it's just wild to see how it works. I mean, you know, there are times when Wizards would attend Gen Con and spend unimaginable budgets there. And then the next year, they're like, we're not going to be at Gen Con. You know, if we're going to be at Origins, we're not going to be at Origins. And just vanishes from convention play for a while, just letting Bald Man Games handle. And now it's like, oh, we're going to send lots of people to conventions. We're going to have huge presence at Gen Con, right? Just goes and comes and ebbs and flows.
Right. And then that affects these other things, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we didn't spend $500,000 at Gen Con, so let's use that money to get into stores, or let's use that money to reach out directly to the gamers, right? Via direct sales or direct marketing. And it is really fascinating to watch and see how things work for a while and then don't. Because it worked before, so why isn't it working now? Because everything changes. And you can study the past, and then you may have to repeat it if you don't, but you will probably have to repeat it even if you do study it. So that's just the way of life.
Speaking of the past,
Yes, Tales from the Infinite Staircase, the adventures that are within this product have been revealed. Roll20 revealed this on their pre-order page. So we will be getting Beyond the Crystal Cave, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks, Pharaoh, The Lost Caverns of Socanth, The Lost City, and When a Star Falls. You can run them individually, or you can put them together in a series, which takes player characters from levels 1 to 13. And this is the quote from that Roll 20 reveal. The infinite staircase spirals in a dreamlike expanse with doors leading to fantastic realms. It's home to the noble genie Nafis, who hears wishes made throughout the multiverse and recruits heroes to fulfill them. These pleas summon adventurers to the lost caverns, suffused with magical energy, fairy tale gardens in the Feywild, futuristic spaceships, and other wondrous locales. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. I am excited to see Pharaoh reach a new generation of players, as well as these other adventures. Though, it is always with that curiosity of, wow, I'd hope that Pharaoh and the larger three adventure arc would have become sort of like Tomb of Annihilation, right? There would be a remake inspired by that that would make for a really neat kind of sands desert adventure. Similarly, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks could be the impetus for, a whole hardback adventure that would take that experience and refine it. Because there are some real flaws to a lot of these, and I'm very curious what they'll do. I mean, Pharaoh could really use some sensitivity consulting, as we talked about when we reviewed it. Barrier Peaks has all these empty, endless rooms of nothing that don't create great experiences, and the key card system's a little weird. Will they update those, right? And that'll be just very interesting to see. Beyond the Crystal Cave has some very interesting experiences. In fact, it was kind of remade for D&D Encounters season, and that met with mixed results because its experience is very different than your typical D&D adventure. And so will they tweak that, or will they just kind of, file a few bits off here and there? I'm very curious to see how this goes.
Yep, we will probably take a look at that when it comes out. Definitely we'll look at it for Pharaoh, as you and I are big fans of Pharaoh. So
Love it.
we'll see how that goes. And speaking of building new things, we now know more about the LEGO D&D collaboration. LEGO has revealed its set. We are getting the Red Dragon's Tale. That was the winner of that competition where you could submit your D&D theme set. The winner was Lucas Bolt from Amsterdam. His design has been adapted into a 3,745 piece set that includes a tavern, a castle, and then the Red Dragon. We're going to get a beholder, an owlbear, a displacer beast, a gelatinous cube, an orc rogue, a gnome fighter, an elf wizard, and a dwarf cleric. The set will cost you $360. It becomes available on April 4th or April 1st in LEGO stores and on their website. And if you purchase this between April 1st and 7th, you will receive an exclusive Mimic dice box. You want to
Yeah,
tell
and
us
they
what else we
also,
get from LEGO?
yeah, they announced a set of 12 minifigs that will release in September. It's hard to get that information, but we've seen some pictures. There's a Mind Flayer with a very cute Intellect Devourer companion. Strahd is there, the Lady of Pain. It looks really neat. Tasha and several others. That looks exciting. And to promote all of this, there will be a free fifth level adventure inspired by the Red Dragon's Tale set. You start in the tavern, you uncover a sorcerer's scheme, maybe you'll face a red dragon. You can apparently optionally kind of build the set and play as you build the set, or maybe use parts of it. It's unclear exactly what the D&D Beyond article was hinting at there, but there's this sort of option to do that. You can run it with or without the D&D rules, which is very clever. So you don't, you know, somebody who bought this set because it looks cool could play a game of D&D without actually turning to the rules, which is very cool. There are four character sheets based on minifigs, and it'll be available, interestingly, only in PDF form on April 1st on D&D Beyond, which is strange because often D&D Beyond has refused to give us PDFs when we've asked for them for various digital offerings. So for whatever reason, through whatever agreement with Lego, this is only in PDF, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Lastly, there's an actual play.
Yeah.
Filmed at the Lego house with DM Anjali Bimani, Ginny D, and Luis Carrazzo, the fan designer Lucas Bolt, and Lego designer Jordan Scott. And this releases April 6th on Lego.com, pre-filmed. It'll also be on the YouTube and Twitch channels, so you can watch that game as they play through the free adventure.
One thing that's not in our show notes that I just have to add, because it happened while I was sitting at a table playing, is that Tome of Beasts 1 from Kobold Press has been added to, or is about to be added to, D&D Beyond. This is yet another partner being brought in to D&D Beyond to give offerings of non-Wizards of the Coast content to D&D Beyond users. Some people speculated that maybe Wizards of the Coast would not reach out to Kobold Press because Kobold Press went and made their own version of D&D, Tales from the Valiant, the Black Flag project, if you will. And apparently this didn't bother Wizards of the Coast much because they brought in Kobold Press, and Kobold Press had to agree to this. So hope any bad blood that was there seems to be patched up, at least for the moment.
I'm glad to see that, right? That would be an easy thing for somebody on either side to say, we're not talking to you. Because there is that, both, you know, D&D could see it as, wow, you guys, we were partners and you went off and did something that you, boy, really heavily uses D&D, and we could quibble about that, but won't, for legal reasons. But you know, we're not super in love with that. And on the Kobold Press side, you could see them saying, well, you know, you guys had that whole OGL debacle and we're trying to get out from under you, and this is sort of competitive. But yet they were able both to set that aside and work for what is surely in both of their interests, and I'm sure will create good sales for both. So that's great. There's a lot of question online about, does this signify something in particular around Kobold Press not really being behind Tales of the Valiant, or D&D feeling a particular way? And I don't think it has any greater meaning, right? I think it means they were able to set aside those differences, and that this is a good revenue stream for everybody, right? This is a popular monster book, a great thing to add to D&D Beyond, and everybody will make good money, right? It's not like Kobold Press announced Tales to the Valiant and sunset all of its 5e things. No, it very gladly sells all of those, and this is a great way to sell those too.
Yeah, and you know, really what it says in the long run, as Teo said, is everyone who's in the industry, obviously they want to make money, but they want what's best for the players. They want this hobby to succeed. Wizards of the Coast wants this hobby to succeed. Kobold Press wants this hobby to succeed. And, you know, so doing so means sometimes sharing, sometimes partnering, sometimes doing things that you think are right, and then you realize, no, maybe that's not the best way to go about this. And that's what this says. So, you know, anyone who ran off and supported Kobold Press because they were sticking it to the man, they weren't, right?
Right.
They were doing what they thought was best at the time, and now they're doing what they think is best at this time.
Yeah, that's what companies have to do. They're all companies that have to feed mouths, right?
So, so it says the outrage machine. If you are a proponent of the outrage machine, you are definitely going to be disappointed over time with every single company, because the company that you think and you're standing behind with your pitchfork and torch, and saying, "Ah, we hate wizards, so we're behind this company." Strap in, baby, because you are going to start seeing some partnerships, I'm sure, where you're like, "Wow, really? They're going to partner with wizards? Okay." So get ready to be outraged at every single company ever in the
I
history
mean,
of the world.
an example of that happened this weekend when it, or maybe it was late last week when it came out that Matt Mercer and Deborah Ann Woll have read through and provided opinions on the next Dungeon Master's Guide, right? And that's largely a marketing move, right? To show, hey, these folks are behind it. But you know, was Critical Role going to say, no, sorry, we are making a new role-playing game, we're in competition with you? No. Anybody who's an adult recognizes this is an ecosystem, and you are in the ecosystem, and you're better off when you appreciate each other and are genuine around that, right? And you don't pretend like there are hard lines, because there aren't. That's the way it works in this industry. I mean, folks and fans like to pretend this, but you know, it was always interesting during the edition wars of fourth edition and Pathfinder how there would be these comments by fans of, say, Pathfinder when the staff were moving back and forth and playing games together, right, on both sides. It wasn't the hard divide that folks like to pretend it was, and it's better when the companies also reflect that and all the individuals involved reflect.
And a couple things to add from our creator and crowdfunding corner. Surviving Strange Hollow Kickstarter still going. I've got my Strange Hollow hat on here. I met with some of the staff, some of the writers, layout person for the book. And we had a great time at GaryCon hanging out and chatting. You can go to get.accidentalpsychops.com. The campaign ends on the 4th of April at 11 a.m. Eastern. Thank you, thank you, thank you to those of you who have helped so far. And if you're on the fence, please know we are going to work as hard as we possibly can to make an experience in this book that you will remember as a 5e player or game master for a long time.
Awesome.
And Teos, you got a chance to play Daggerheart.
I did. I joined the awesome folks at D20 Play. So Tom Christie was DM. DM David was there as a player. Several other fine folk. You can find, there's a link in our show notes, or check out the D20 Play channel on YouTube. You can find the game where we ran through the playtest adventure. It's included in the playtest packet. And overall, it was a lot of fun. Having read Candela Obscura, I was curious whether this would be a game that I was like, eh, you know, it's so-so. But actually, this is a lot of fun for me. What I found interesting is that it's surprisingly tactical, and it's even more surprising because it says this is a very narrative game. It actually says that, and then you start reading the rules, you go, "Ooh, for a narrative game, I'm tracking a lot." Big potential for swinginess. In one encounter, almost all of our attacks either missed or generated fear, which meant our GM got to go because there's sort of a no initiative, but the GM gets a turn when kind of mechanic. And so it meant that the GM was going all the time, which really broke up our play, and was sort of surprising to all of us. But the characters are really fun. The concepts are a lot of fun. I liked my frog or ribbit rogue that I played. It's the kind of game that I can really enjoy. It felt kind of fourth edition-ish, in that kind of level of like tactics and which of your features you'll use and how do they come together. But what I found surprising is that I had expected this to be the Critical Role RPG. And if that is the intent, I think that Critical Role should kind of dial back that tactical nature. If this is a Critical Role RPG, just one of many, sort of the way companies publish board games, then cool. You know, let's have a fun tactical game that some people will enjoy. But if you want a lot of people to enjoy a game, this is too tactical for most players, right? It's the kind of thing where in my turn, I was making six decisions, and there were four things to track, you know, four little units of currency, some for the DM, some for me. And that's a lot. That's a lot of headspace. Not a lot of people like that. I like that. A lot of people don't. So it was fun, a great time. But yeah, I'd be curious to see what they do and whether they dial that all down and how.
Awesome. Well, that was our news. In our main topic this week here on Mastering Dungeons, we are going to talk about designing a starting RPG adventure. So last week, we created a village, because it takes a village, Teos. It takes a village.
So I hear.
And so now that we've done that, we want to create a starting adventure. We are going to, for the sake of this particular discussion, go with the premise that you, as the DM, know the rules. You know, you've run before, you are just getting ready to start a new campaign. You've created the starting village, so here we go. And we are going to assume that the players at your table also know the game. So this will not need to teach you, the DM, or you will not need to teach the players how to play the game. So everyone's starting with an understanding of at least the rules, if not, you know, a really firm understanding of everything. So let's talk about the starting adventure. First, you want to follow on from everything that you've done with your village. The village you've designed has been designed a particular way for a particular reason. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and listen to last week's podcast and then jump forward to this one. So the village will tell you some things about how you're going to start. But let's talk about this first adventure. The first question is, Teos, what?
Well, did you have a session zero? That's the most important part before you just jump into that first session. Got to lay the groundwork.
That's right. And we've talked about session zeros before here, going all the way back when we were differently named and when we've had different hosts. So you can also go back and read any blog or, you know, story or whatever on session zeros.
Yeah, but just if I can jump in here, you know, we've talked about this before, but session zeros in the particularly around this, how you're going to start, you want to know whether the things you're going to dish out are things that the players are looking for, right? So if this is a deep intrigue, houses against each other, politics, diplomacy, Game of Thrones type thing, you kind of want to know whether the players want that, because they may go, actually, I hate that stuff, right? Or if you're going to do a live off of your off the land and sometimes running out of food and track your water gallons, you also want to know whether your players are in for that. And everything in between, right? So that understanding of that what I'm going to serve up is what they like. Well, right there, that's a giant win, that you're aware that these are within the parameters they're looking for. Or even things like the challenge level, right? The level of role playing, those kinds of things, really helpful as a starting premise.
Yeah. And so that is one issue that people have when they hear session zero. Some people just think it's character creation. That's not what session zero is. You're talking about the personal side of things, the scheduling side of things, the social side of things, the safety tools sorts of things, campaign expectations, etc. And then maybe you are also talking about the characters you're going to play. And if you make them now, if you make them on your own, if you make them together as a group, that stuff can go in. So in that session zero, I would ask, did you make the connections between the characters? Are these characters already a group that know each other? Are they individuals who will come together during the adventure? Or are they individuals who may know each other partially or may have a connection that they don't even know about yet? All of these questions will need to be answered before you begin to design this adventure. If you have not made those connections yet, maybe it's because you have a good reason not to. Do you not want to have them meet because you want them to meet in a surprising way, in a way that adds depth to the story that you're going to be telling with them?
You all have a
That's
role
okay.
on the caravan to Icewind Dale, right? And so
Exactly.
that job that you have will play out over time, and therefore you want them to not know each other, but just show up and then band together over time.
And that's fine. You can find a way to make that fun, and you could find a way to make that work. Oftentimes, though, the oomph to that, the power of that is left up to how well the characters and the players can do it. And so you may not connect them because you want them to connect totally during play. And it often falls flat. It may not get to the point where you are getting a deeper story or deeper meanings or a better connection because you waited to do so during play. So you may just want to do it during the session zero and say, you know her for this reason, and you don't know anyone yet, but you will. But you are three that have shared caravan duty before. And you then it helps them role play, and it helps you build the world and build the story that's coming.
Absolutely. And it's surprising, but it really what it is that there's often a high friction point when you're supposed to pretend you don't know each other and that you aren't the characters at the table. And so overcoming that can be a little difficult unless you kind of quickly pull everybody together in some way that makes sense.
And there are ways I've seen it done that are great, but that would be a different show. It's very intricate, and even the best plan can go wrong with the wrong kind of player. Not the wrong kind of player, but just a play style that doesn't match that. All right, so if you didn't bring the characters together, now's the time that you have to do that because they're all going to be sitting at the table. So now's the time to bring them together. Why? Because in my experience, games are deeper and more fulfilling when the characters have a reason to role play with each other. It doesn't have to be an elaborate backstory. But if there is some connection between the two, it gives some grist for that mill to have the players talk to each other. Why is it great to have them talk to each other? Because it gives you, the game master, a second to rest and think, and it gives you some fodder to bring into the story in ways that help everybody tell a better story. I wanted to mention Fiasco. We're covering Fiasco in class, and that is a great game for establishing these relationships and then building up on them to tell a story. And in that game, you have a relationship with at least one other character or two other characters, regardless of how many players are playing. And then you have like an object or a need, what's the last one, or a location that binds you together. And so just that one thing, right? Just that there's a coin collection that's between us. And then you can decide what that means. But just that one connection can lead to so much fun and a really deep story if you use them well. So just make some connection, even if it's later revealed to be a connection, make something there that they have to play off of between each other.
Absolutely.
So when do you bring them together? As soon as possible. You can make it gradual as long as that connection progresses in a promising way. So you don't need to sit down and say, all right, you are their cousin, and you don't have to do that, but hint at a connection and then constantly be moving toward it. Hey, don't I know you? Haven't I seen you before somewhere? I don't know. You do seem familiar. And then you go forward and you go forward, and it slowly reveals what that connection is.
Yeah, and it like we talked about the Blade Runner adventure, right? When we reviewed that, the box set adventure does this interesting thing where it starts with two characters, with one of them saying, "Hey, you've got to come in, you grumpy Blade Runner, you," and I'm the robot Blade Runner that is, bringing you in because I play by the rules, and just lets them kind of chat. And it's fine. It works perfectly fine in play when I've run it and when I've played it. But it's like, it's just sort of a strange thing that two players get to do together. And then everybody goes to a meeting and the rest of the people are there. And more interesting would be if you had three introductory scenes that had some reason why it was important to those particular characters. That could actually showcase their connections, showcase what they do, and then bring them all together in the very next scene. That could be a really fun way to do it too, right? Because it would play off of build upon all of those differences and kind of tell those particular stories. But yeah, how you come up with that? I mean, you could rack your brain forever, but it's worth giving it the thought, of what you're going to do to bring players together and give them the reason to dig into their backstories and their connections.
And so the big question is then how? How do you bring them together? The most powerful way is a pre-existing relationship. It doesn't have to, as I said before, be a 20-page backstory, but it could just be you were both from the same guild, you were both from the same orphanages, anything that just gives that slightest connection that can be built upon, any connection. At the very least, though, you want to provide them with goals that allow them to work together, and don't put the characters at odds in ways that would make them want to kill each other. So get them moving toward the same goal. If later on there is a conflict, I want to take the item and give it to the church. You want to take the item and give it to the king. That's one thing. But don't start with any sort of conflict because you can derail the whole campaign before it even starts by doing that. Get everybody moving on the same train in the same direction with the same or at least similar goals to smooth the skids, to get them going that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And this all reminds me of when we were starting the Ashes of Athas campaign, and we were thinking about how in Dark Sun, there's often this sort of like, we're all not great people or less than in a typical campaign, and therefore we might fight each other, right? Or be opposed to one another because it's a world of gladiatorial pits and things like that. And so it was a concern that the players might approach it with like, you know, I'm this kind of character and I'm going to be against you. I'm nefarious, whatever. And Chris Sims, who was helping us with the start of the campaign, said, you know what? What you've got to do is kind of give them a solid punch that unites them all together, right? Put some blood in their mouth and a reason to all have skin in the game and working as a group. And he said, let's make them all members of the Veiled Alliance and have the Veiled Alliance attack. So they all have a group. They've all been under duress and they band together to overcome it. And that starts everybody off on the right foot, right? With a goal, a purpose, a bond. And it was brilliant. We all were just like, clap, clap. Yes, Chris, we will do what you say. That's amazing. And it
And
worked out.
that, now that you mention it, that was one of the most powerful openings to a campaign that I can remember. For exactly for that reason,
Hats
right?
off to
It
Chris.
was who are we? Who are we? Wait a second, our world is collapsing around us, and we only have each other to rely on.
And it so it took it answered with one start all the potential problems we're looking at kind of thematically around the campaign and how to get players excited to do stuff together and that lasted through the campaign because it was such a strong start and motivating story of the remnants of the Veiled Alliance and trying to figure out who did this to you and why and all that. It was great.
Sure. All right. So now that we are figuring out this connection between the characters, we need to figure out if we're going to start like with a bang or are we going to ease into the action? And how you do it will depend on the purpose and the content. So, in any sort of exploration, and it doesn't even have to be games, right? But in any sort of story, where you're moving forward, you want to start with the known. You want people to be on solid footing and then move off into the unknown. So if your setting is known, if the players understand that, okay, this is a medieval fantasy, or even if it's science fiction, as long as you know that the type of play is going to be familiar and the setting is known, you've established the basics in your session zero, then you can assume that the players are firmly in the known, and you can start with a bang. You can start in medias res. You can just jump forward and hit them with action right away. If you're starting the campaign in a place where it might be unfamiliar to the players, you're going to use a different setting where the rules are slightly different, or the setting has some weird qualities to it that aren't in a regular setting. Then you might want to ease into it, give some role-playing opportunities, which will provide some exposition to help make the setting known before you hit them with something unknown. That is a general rule of thumb that I try to use. What do you think, Tapes?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, it makes me think of any kinds of like Wild Beyond the Witchlight, right? Like starting a little more slowly because it's like, hey, here's this fake circus, and maybe we're gonna walk around and take it in. And so you don't need that. If you started with a bang, there would be so many things to explain that it would be a little confusing. And but then if you take something like Lost Mines, where you start with an ambush. That makes sense because it's caravan duty and guard duty, and even if you've never played D&D before, you can get the gist of where you are and what's going on. Sure.
And if you do ease into it and start with exposition, you want to avoid the box text problem, right? You don't want to sit and read for 20 minutes about each individual god and what's in the town, right? You want to allow player interaction to drive that rather than a lore dump. You would rather have them asking questions of you rather than you telling them the answer to questions that they have not yet asked. There are some things where you can assume that this is important to know, right? It's the show, don't tell. Show if you can, but tell if you must, and get that information to them so you can then jump quickly into the unknown, which is where the game wants you to drive your characters toward.
Yeah, and I think that idea of starting with a bang is great. It's one of the things that Mike Shea talks about in his Lazy DM book, because it really just gets you right into the flow of D&D, right? Some quick encounter, something like that, some problem to solve, everybody immediately starts jumping into the game and having fun with that. If you don't do that, then you want to think about, well, why was this a great session of D&D, right? If this is the start and this is going to be my first session or two, but especially thinking of that first session, if all of it were like speaking to merchants at a guild hall, while that may lay the groundwork for understanding the guild that will feature prominently in the campaign, it's not the most exciting D&D. So what will make this memorable, right? And I think of Chris Perkins gave an example once of you meet in a tavern and your employer to be, this wizard, comes in to give you the typical, here's the information. And as they start to do so, they suddenly get this strange look. And then they keel over, falling onto the table, and there's a dagger sticking in their back. Suddenly things got exciting, right? So you can get that build and then be like, oh, wait a minute, what are we all, now we're on to what might feel like D&D, right? The people, and they can sink their teeth into, where'd they go? Let's look for clues, right? That gets all that session, that interest bit that you want, something exciting. And you'll see the same thing in novels and TV, right? Like they'll give you some interesting build up, whatever, lay the foundation, and then something exciting is going to come along.
Yeah, and that leads to the next question, which are you going to provide a hook right away to get them started, or do they have to search for the hook? And generally, I would say provide the hook right away. Don't make them search for the hook. But giving the hook too soon can lead to tunnel vision if they need to know something else in order to play. Right. So if they do need information in order to make decisions, you might not want to give them a hook right away. You don't want to say, Right. You need to go off to these, the orc caves, the troll caves, to do this. And then the players are completely focused on the troll cave and they don't take the time or don't even want to take the time to learn that, oh, by the way, the troll caves used to be the lair of this, which is an important part of what they're about to encounter. So be careful about giving the hook too soon. You want to give it as soon as you can, but think about what they might need to know, what the players and the characters might need to know before you give them that hook.
And or that it might even become a trail of hooks, where you go, well, the big hook is I want to get to these caves, and that's going to be exciting that we're going off to the troll caves or the orc caves. But if you first want them to, interview the survivors of the caravan that went by the place and were attacked, then you want to first start with that something happened to this caravan hook. Go talk to them, figure the things out, and they will tell you where the troll cave is. And sometimes when if you play enough adventures, you will find these adventures that give you the things too soon. And that's something that's really important to think of when you're doing your campaigns. And if you do that, if you're a homebrew DM who kind of improvises, right, and just kind of throws in some bits and then plays off of that, well, that's fine too. If you mention a hook too early, you just need someone else to come in and set that straight and say, hey, I see you gearing up. Before you do that, I'll tell you what'll save your hide. You got to talk to the people who've been through this. Go talk to, so and so.
And it may seem a little awkward, but in the long run, you'll be forgiven because we know it's a game and we know that, we need information to play. Right. As a story, if I was reviewing a novel, that I'd roll my eyes and say, oh boy, right. But it's a game, it's not a
It's a
novel.
game,
So therefore, and that, this novel talk reminds me of a teacher I had. He was a Canadian writer named Doug Glover. And he taught his students what he called the theory of globs, which I think is an amazing thing. And this theory that Doug was like a mad scientist of a writer. And his thing was, you're doing several things when you write a story, when you create a story, right? You're One phrase or sentence might be exposition, where you're explaining a thing. One might be characterization, where you're showing the reader who the character is. One might be moving action forward. One might be a flashback to describe something. And so there are many purposes. And each of these little phrases, sentences, or even individual words sometimes has this purpose. So he calls those things globs. And you want to be able to do something like this. Name what that thing is, what glob is it fulfilling, and highlight it with a marker, with a highlighter. And when you're done highlighting your story, you want it to look like a rainbow. You want, even within a sentence, to have different colors because you're doing different things and you're deepening the story. So rather than a flashback that goes on for 5 pages, that would be 5 pages of orange highlighter. You're losing opportunities when you do that. You want this phrase to be orange and then this phrase to be pink and then this phase a phrase to be green. You're doing multiple things. And it's like that here. Right. You want to not just move forward the entire time. Encounter after, you want to take the time to intersperse in this exposition. You want to intersperse in some world building with the forward moving action. The more you can do that, the deeper and deeper. And you're right, this is like high level stuff.
Yeah,
This is like,
but it
yeah.
is really important. When I think about Rime of the Frost Maiden, one of the really kind of intriguing, fascinating, strange parts of the adventure is that it says to you, hey, welcome to the start of this adventure. You're not new to Icewind Dale. You're not new to the Rime. But that's the name of this adventure. And you, as the player, don't know anything about all this stuff.
Right.
Hey, go find Chwingas or go, on this other quest. And that messes it up because now you're not getting that dual purpose, right? And it's interesting that the two Adventurers League intros that were written for that season, you wrote one, Paige Layton wrote the other, I believe. Those intros both have a sort of you are on a caravan aspect dealing with this winter effect and the problems of it and working your way towards Icewind Dale while learning about what's happening. That all those are these globs you're talking about serving multiple purposes, helping you feel like what you are, which is a new player to this setting, right? And your character needs some ability to express that. Why am I asking questions? Why am I learning? Wild Beyond Witchlight had this problem before. I've talked about this before, where it says one of you could be a member of the circus. Well, then you know everything. How does that work, right? Like, if you're going to know everything, how do you ask questions? As you know, you'd want to have answers, and you don't have the answers. In fact, you'd almost want to skip all of it, and that doesn't make any sense, right? And so, having those, when we look at the start of an adventure, how can we do those dual things of getting you started, getting you to learn about the setting, getting you to understand and form relationships with whatever this home base is, and begin to tease out that story, right? You want all those things coming together, but not to the point where it confuses you. And I think that's the art of it, right? Like those globs, you don't want to do it in an overwhelming way where nobody can sort what's, you want those things to be tangible, right? And like the examples that we gave of like the Rime of the Frostmaiden thing, those intro adventures did a really good job of saying like, hey, you're a caravan person. That's your grounding, which doesn't require explanation, right? You've got no questions. You know what's that. That's solid. Now you start learning about the winter. Good. Now you start worrying about the types of threats that are working on and the questions people have. And now something happens you must overcome, so you band together, right? Those give it to you all while there are multiple things happening. They're happening in a way that you can digest it all and keep it separate. You know what's background, you know what's setting and all that, and you know what's the adventure.
As you interact with the NPC who's giving you a quest, you're also learning that NPC is from Bryn Shander. And because they're wearing this fur or, this embellishment, you know, oh, you learn either right out or through history check that this is why they wear this, and this is what it means about what Bryn Shander means to the Ten Towns, and et cetera, et cetera. So you're still moving forward. You're still moving forward with the adventure, but you are learning, deepening the story, deepening the world as you move forward. So let's talk for a second about adventure hooks. Adventure hooks are the way that the player and their character learn about the issue and are enticed into going forward. So you want to introduce the characters to the adventure they're playing, and you want to do so in a way that makes the player want to go on the adventure. Even if the character doesn't, the player will still want to because, surprisingly, they control the character. So what are some ways to provide this hook? Right? One way is just plain old money, goods, cash, magic items, things that are valuable probably to the character, and most players are trying to level up, buy things, earn things, get magic items. So that's one way. That's usually a pretty good way to entice most players and characters. The goodness of your heart, right? You are a good person and you don't want the world to end, so you are going to go on this mission. That hooks probably less folks, but at least it is something that throughout most stories that we've learned, people do things because they want good to succeed in the world over evil.
Yeah, it's my favorite, and I don't know if this is you'd include this or not, but in general, just solving the problem, right? Like, and I think that's why I dislike one of the reasons I dislike things like rats in a basement or caravan duty as its own thing, is that none of it is sort of captivating, and the goodness of it is like, well, I don't know, you're somehow still maintaining a working tavern with these rats in the basement. So sure, it's good that I get rid of them, but this is nothing heroic. This is nothing great, right? Now, if you say there are mysterious sounds in the basement, while I might be disappointed as a player that they happen to be rats, that's your explanation, Mr. Adventure Writer. At least it's intriguing to the character. What's making the noises in the basement? When did these start, right? And it's the idea of helping out, but it's that curiosity that's dovetailing into it, right? There is a death curse. Why? What's going on? How can we, you start getting into problem-solving mode.
Yeah. In-game rewards are also important, obviously, like experience points if you use that, or just the general storytelling things, or mechanics. After you succeed at four encounters, you get a boon, or this or that, if depending on the game you're playing. So that sort of thing. The reason I bring this up is because over the years in organized play, there were so many different kinds of characters that I would end up writing 27 different adventure hooks to try to entice every kind. Oh, well, you're an evil-ish character. And money doesn't mean anything to you. So what might be another hook? And that's why the factions were so nice at the start of fifth edition. Because if everyone joined a faction, you could just say, all right, these five factions, here are five different reasons why this faction would want you to go on this mission. So I will make those.
Yeah, totally. And that sense of belonging and purpose is kind of cool too, right? When you're like, oh, my faction sent me here, right? That feels good. It feels like you're part of something, and that's also motivating, right? Secrets might be revealed over time because of this group that I'm associated with. That's neat. The rules in Tasha's and Eberron for a patron are fantastic for that purpose. Or ACK Inc. having a franchise, right? This sense of belonging gives you that unstated. Really, it's stated, the stated direction, the overarching, you have a reason, you have an impetus, you have a thing that you're doing, right? If you've got some larger motivation, like we are maintaining the tavern that we all own, right? That's now important. We need these resources for this. That is a huge driver as well.
Yeah. And most importantly, especially if you're a player, if nothing in the adventure, if you feel like your character would not be hooked by anything that's presented, make up one. You become a storyteller as the game expects you to be, and say, you know what, my character's not interested in money or being good, but this person, this merchant who is asking us to go search for their lost caravan, they may have connections that I could use down the line. So I'm going to do it for that reason. Heck, my evil god has given me a vision that by helping this merchant, it will lead to more down the road. So I'm going to do it, right? You have the agency to, even if the DM does not agree, in your own mind, you have the agency to create what your character would be thinking in order to get you on this adventure.
Yeah, and those can be so powerful over time, surprisingly so, when you decide to create your own motivating factor. It may feel like you're applying a band-aid. And I mean, in some ways, sure, stepping out, like it's sort of a band-aid because look, social contract. I'm here with a bunch of people to play a game. If I'm going to drag my feet and cause a problem, this will be no fun, right? Like, I don't want to, let's not go down to the basement where the probably it's just rats. Like, that's no fun, right? And when you come up with that motivating factor, even one that seems like, totally at odds and secret, it could really be great. Like I had a ale cursed dwarf who could not taste ale unless he did something good. And he did not want to do good things, but he loved ale. So he would begrudgingly go on every quest because it would suddenly give him a little bit of that taste, and it was so much fun. And that became a funny running gag for everybody, right? As why I was doing it. And of course, eventually the heart of gold gets revealed, and I end up being more in league with the characters because otherwise that would eventually be too big attention. So it makes more sense for my character to over time become better, right? And But that initial impetus was a great way that I could be evil-ish, you know, grumpy, whatever, but totally play along with what the rest of the party was doing.
And then as the game master who hears Teos do this, I'm going, this is perfect. Because now in my mind, I'm like, we have to have an adventure where the dwarf gets back his taste. And how, you know, what will change. And, oh, I have an alchemist who promises to create a potion that will undo this. And you're right. So now I have adventures and I have hooks and I have all of these ways to make the campaign deeper just because you invented something on your own.
Right. And your character will shine as a result of it and will fit into the group. And it's great versus just being some curmudgeon at the table that makes things not fun.
So the other thing I want to say about adventure hooks, and Teo sort of already mentioned this, but I think it bears repeating, is don't give away the whole game in the hook. You only need to get the character started on the trail. You don't need to reveal what's going on down the line. And it's generally better that way. So just give them enough information to get them to that first place where they're going to have an encounter, hear more clues, move forward. If you give away too much in the hook, and one of the problems I had with an adventure I ran this weekend was that's what happened, right? Mm-hmm. The hook gave so much away that the players knew too much to be able to actually take on these encounters. They were three steps ahead of what the encounters were, so they could either ignore or bypass or otherwise not appreciate the encounters that they were having because they were already moving far, far down the road.
Yeah, it's like if you took something like Curse of Strahd and from the very beginning you revealed all the ways to beat Strahd, right? That's too early. You want some payoff down the road. It's fine to give a little tip of a vision of an artifact or something, but you want that payoff over time, and the players want that too. They may not quite recognize it, but it plays better that way. And you like mysteries where it's like sort of like, you know, alien horror movies where they don't show you the whole monster right up front, because that would just take all the fun out of it, right? Seeing a little, it's the results of its being here, right, gets you on edge. Yeah. And then there's the small payoff of more characteristics, right? The acid for blood, the weird goo, right? All that sort of stuff. And then it's the glimpses and then the whole thing. And, that's a whole fun.
And there's two pieces of advice that seem to be at odds, but aren't, right? The one piece of advice is don't give away everything right away. The other piece of advice is give a very specific call to action and first step. And those are two separate things, and you want to balance that. You want to be specific. You need to do this right now in order to start. But you don't, you know, let the mystery build, as Teo says. Let there be surprises and changes and deepening of the story over time.
Yeah. And that call to action, I mean, sometimes it's overstated. Like I think in Adventurers League, sometimes they force the format of it where you have to write what all these things are, and you have to write what all the hooks are. And sometimes it's like, look, you're on a caravan that's just hit by an avalanche. You're going to want to survive. We don't have to overdo this, folks. Like, it's pretty clear what everybody's motivating factor is. And sometimes those are the best ways to start with something that's really obvious, right? You know, you're in the tavern, it's under attack. Well, I know what we're all going to do because we all want to live. Like, that's not shocking, right? Shocking would be if you say, actually, you want to join the enemies, right? Like, well, that would take some work. But if it's obvious, let that play out and you don't have to overthink it. And sometimes that is the most fun approach. And think about whatever your hook is, whatever your impetus for the call to action kind of thing, you know, is there some reason this wouldn't play out, right? Like, you know, if there's a fight in the street and you expect them to back one side, you know, you want to think through and make sure that's what they're really going to do if your story depends on it. And hopefully it doesn't if you're going to leave it ambiguous. But if you really expect everybody to join the, you know, the bully, well, that needs to be supported by everything you've presented the players with.
For sure. That's a good start. I think it's a good start. I think there's more to talk about here, but we are out of time. So we're going to talk about that next week. And we are going to say thank you so much, everyone, for your support. For those of you out there who are listeners, thank you. If you have joined our Patreon, thank you so much. Teos is putting on his devil horns while I thank our Master Dungeon supporters. I met many of our Master of Realms supporters and Master of the Multiverse supporters at GameholeCon. So thank you so much, all of those folks who support us. For the Masters of the Multiverse, I'm going to tell thank you to Keith Ammon of The Monsters Know What They're Doing, Lou Anders of Lazy Wolf Studios, Craig Bailey, Steve Bissonette, Merrick Blackman, Evil John, Andy Edmonds at Nerdronomicon, who I definitely said hello to, Nathan Fuller, The Mighty Jerd, Ben Heisler and Paige Lightman, Sean Hurst, I'm sorry I didn't get the chance to meet the little one, Chad Jackson, Brian King, Jim Klingler, aka DM Prime Mover, Chad Lench, the Mathemagician, Eric Menge, John Mickey, Sean Molly, Falcon Neal, Tom Nelson of the Deck of Player Safety, who I also said hello to at GaryCon, Mike Olson, Mighty Zeus, Post Fiction RPG Audio, Robert Pasley, Vladimir Prenner from Croatia, Chance Russo at Drago Russo, who I said hello to, Ross Sandberg, Andy Shockney, Krishna Simose, Trace, Joe Tyler, James Walton, Graham Ward, Javier Wasiek, and Webb Krister. I had to say that wrong because Chris Webster wanted me to mangle his name like we do with Krishna. So I've done that. Chris was at one of my tables. Great player, great time. So thank you to our listeners. If you would like to become a patron of our show, thank you. You can go to patreon.com/masteringdnd. You can also leave us a review either on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this podcast that will help spread the joy of Mastering Dungeons. You can also hit subscribe on our YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/masteringdungeons. If you want your ear holes to please, but also your eye holes as we look at you and speak. So, Teos, where can people find you on social media?
Oh, I wish you could find me at the Duke Blue Devil game, but I just always am afraid that if I go there, I'll jinx it. So instead, you can find me at alphastream.org. All of my creations are found from there. Sean, where are you hiding?
I am on all the social medias that are important at Sean Merwin. The podcast is also available at Mastering D&D on all of those places. You could join our community on Patreon as always and ask us questions there. And you can leave us comments or ask questions on our YouTube channel. So we are off. We are starting. We are hooked and we are ready to go on an adventure, Teos. So what should we do now?
Well, I'm going to go to the provision keeper, the store, and go on an expensive shopping session, even though all the other players don't want to go through this.
Yeah, you're gonna have a hard time getting me out of the tavern, Teos. That's all I'm saying.
We're the worst players.
We're terrible.